listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and I'm flying solo today as my co-host extraordinaire, psychologist Dr. Melody Fox, is extending this wonderful vacation we had one more day. But what doesn't change is each week we bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Now, we will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many great ways to keep your family and your life mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And we will continue to bring you some of those incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our topic today is transforming your conversations. Now, do you ever notice how conversations, depending on which way they go, can change you? They can change your relationship. They can even change your career. Now, with me today are two of the authors of Conversation Transformation. This is a new book that I believe will leave you not only with a keen awareness of exactly how communication breaks down, but also with practical skills to make even the most difficult conversations more productive. Now, to tell us more about this are Dr. Ben Benjamin and Amy Yeager. Dr. Benjamin is a communications consultant, business coach, and writer. He holds a doctorate in education and is an accomplished teacher trainer. He has trained instructors who have offered his courses throughout the United States and in Europe. He also provides advanced facilitation training to help organizations resolve conflicts and hold more effective meetings. Now, over the past 10 years, Dr. Benjamin's teachings and writing efforts have focused increasingly on SAVI, and which is the System for Analyzing Verbal Interaction. As a certified senior SAVI trainer, he has developed and led customized SAVI courses for a wide range of organizations. Amy Yeager is also a certified senior SAVI trainer, and she has designed and led SAVI trainings for multinational corporations, schools, healthcare organizations, and other nonprofit institutions, as well as individualized coaching programs and web-based seminars for ongoing skill development. Amy received her Bachelor of Arts degree in psychology from Harvard University with a focus on the philosophy of language and conscious experience and the relationship between physical and psychological manifestations of emotion. And that's a mouthful. Ben, Amy, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it is great to have both of you here. I've been reading the book. I'm really excited about the fact that this is a book that not only tells me, you know, kind of what's going on within the communication, what's going on within the brain. But I love the fact that it has given me little training skills, obviously given to me because I'm reading it now, but to anyone else that would read it. There's step-by-step skills in how we can make the changes, which I think is it's a great thing. At times, you know, for someone like myself, I read a lot of books. Sometimes you'll have a book that'll have a great message, but it's not really taking you step by step through. So first of all, I want to thank you for writing the book, because I'm enjoying it, and I see it as something that most anybody could really gain something from.
Great. Well, thank you. Well, we're glad that you're enjoying it. That's something that really meant a lot to us. This book was our way of reaching people who couldn't attend our trainings. You know, we wanted to have a greater impact than everybody that we could just reach in person. And we thought, well, we want to not just give good ideas to people, but actually help them be able to make practical changes. And this is the closest we thought we could get to giving everybody a workshop.
Well, so it sounds like, I mean, that was sort of your motivation for writing it as far as getting it out to the masses. What are some of the other reasons why you felt that it would be important to sit down and actually put this all down on paper?
Well, one of the ways that people resolve conflict is to fight with each other, either physically or emotionally, or actually with guns on the battlefield. That resolving conflict is not something that human beings are particularly good at without resorting to force. And, you know, when we go to school, we learn a lot of things in school. We learn how to do reading and writing, arithmetic, history. We don't learn the skills of how to actually communicate. There's an assumption made that people know how to talk to each other well, and that just isn't true. And so, you know, we wanted to put in writing and have something that people could work on by themselves or anywhere around the world to start enhancing and changing their communication. Because in order to work with anybody else in your work, in your life, in your personal life, in your family, you need to know how to communicate well. And most people have a lot of trouble doing that, even though when things go wrong, they usually think it's the other guy, not them.
Right. Well, and I got to tell you, I met with somebody over the weekend, actually yesterday, and I was talking a little bit about the show. You know, I was sharing them about the show, and one of the things that they brought up, and this was a younger woman, but she said, you know, it's been interesting to her how she's referring to it as her generation, but I mean her generation and some of those younger than her really lost the art of communication because there's so much of what they're doing is either texting or done over – so much of their communication is done over a computer or over a phone that she really feels like when she tries to communicate with some maybe just, you know, 5 or 6 years younger than her, that she just really feels like they're at a loss to have face-to-face communication. Is that something you've seen also that makes this book even more important today than maybe what it was 20 years ago?
Yeah, sure. I'll take that first. I think that's definitely true, and there's a big problem with so much electronic communication out there. Not only is it just less personal, so you get to know people a little bit less or in a different way, but often the meaning of what we say is really changed or is really lost. One of the main points that we make in the book is the importance of voice tone, and that can make the difference between just giving a little piece of information. You know, remember, we have our parent-teacher conference tomorrow at 5, or attacking somebody. Remember, we have our parent-teacher conference tomorrow at 5. So if you're whining, if you're yelling, if you have a little edge in your voice, it really changes the meaning of what you're saying. And if you send a perfectly nice note to somebody, but they read it and interpret it as having some sort of hostility or edge or hidden tone in it, you can send something that you intend to be perfectly friendly, and they get really irritated. And we've actually seen people get fired over these sort of escalating series of emails that go back and forth, and you can have this loss of voice tone and misconstrued meaning in any kind of electronic communication.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a great point, and I was thinking about an email that I was copied with. So I had one friend sending an email to another friend, and I was copied on it, and the friend capitalized a lot of things and put in exclamation points and such. And the second friend copied me with his response, and his response was, "Stop yelling at me."
Mm-hmm.
And then the first person then emailed back, again, I'm being copied with all of this, said, "I'm not yelling. I was letting you know that I'm excited about this."
That's right. Exactly. So it's a poor way to discuss things that are important. You know, if somebody has the possibility to be upset by what you're saying, or if you're going to be giving bad news or you're asking a very charged emotional question, not a good idea to, you know, use email. Much better to pick up the phone or to use Skype or to be in person.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And kind of getting back to the book, one of the things that sunk in with me more than anything else was sort of how simple you were able to explain things and to give analogies. And one of my favorite ones had to do with the analogy of thinking of your brain as a snow-capped mountain. And every time that we think of something or we react to something in a certain way, we're going down that same path. We've set up that groove, and I think you even refer to it as, you know, when people say I'm stuck in a rut, you know, think about that picture. So now I tend to – I'll picture this snow-capped mountain. If I say something or react to something in a particular way, that, you know, is that the right way, or did I just choose that groove? So share with us a little bit about the brain. I think that was one of the things that made this something that I, as I was reading it, I thought, okay, I really get it. This really makes sense, rather than something to where I think, you know, for somebody that may not necessarily have studied the brain, you know, you could use a lot of really big words about different synapses that are firing and things like that. We might not get it. But the whole idea of the snow-capped mountain, I thought, was beautiful.
Right, and this analogy really comes out of current research into neuroplasticity. Again, a big word that just means our brains can change. And that's a major finding that's new just in the past decade. For a very long time, there was this assumption that we really couldn't change our brains over time. That as we got older, if anything, we'd just lose our neurons. We would lose our mental capacity and more ability to learn. And with these very exciting findings that actually we can change a lot, that's opened up new possibilities for learning. And part of what they've learned is that some of what's been observed about difficulty in changing over time doesn't mean that we can't change over time. It just means that we've kept doing the same thing over and over and over again. So as you said, with the snow-capped mountain, if you sled down once, you make sort of a shallow groove. If you sled down 50 times, so if I'm talking to somebody and I am, say, yes-butting, it's something we talk about in the book, I have a tendency to sort of agree with somebody, say, you know, yeah, that's a good idea, but we can't afford it, or it's too expensive. And I keep doing that, keep responding in the same way again and again and again and again. Even though my brain can keep being changed, that snow can keep being altered, if I keep doing the same thing, I'm going to get a really deep groove, which means as I go to communicate the next hour, the next day, the next year, it's going to be more and more and more likely that I'm going to keep repeating the same habitual unconstructive pattern. So in a way, this plasticity, this changeability, it allows for lots of change, but it also allows for this rigidity, that if we keep doing something, it creates this ingrained groove, this ingrained habit. So when we understand that, we get more of a sense of, okay, what do we need to do in order to create a new habit? Well, you need to not only know what you're doing and have this awareness of, oh, you know, I realize I yes, but I realize that that's not the most constructive thing. People, you know, maybe get irritated and argue with me when I yes, but just knowing that alone isn't going to change these grooves in my brain. What do I have to do? I have to build a new groove. And what does that take? It takes practice. So that's why I think you were noticing that there's something different about this book, that we actually give people ways that they can practice and start to build this new habit and not just know what they should do or want to do, but build the skill to do it. So they don't get discouraged, as many people do. When they try to change, they realize they should change, maybe they want to change. It doesn't happen overnight, and of course it doesn't. But if you do engage in repeated structured practice, you can change.
And Ben, do you have anything to add to that?
I think Amy said it really well.
Okay. It had me thinking about, you know, and often in working with families, we'll get the parent that says, well, you know, they're just wired that way. Or they'll say, well, you know, we're taking a child and we're dealing with a drug or alcohol problem. And they'll say, well, you know what? His grandfather was the same way, or his father was the same way, or his mother was the same way, or something like that.
So what you were just doing just now is you were quoting somebody doing a fancy yes, but actually.
You know, oh, really?
He's that's true, but he's wired that way. Yeah, it's true. You know, his uncle was that way. It's sort of explaining it rather than, you know, thinking about what could be different. And you might say, you're right. You know, we do, our body is wired in our brain a certain way. And every time we do the same thing, the same response, it gets wired even better. And that's true. And I'm wondering if you're interested in ways that we can rewire your brain. Does that interest you?
Yeah.
You know, so that would put it back to them and agree with them that it is true. What they said is true. And are they interested in ways that things could be different? And then you open up a whole conversation, possibly, that maybe, oh, maybe get they'll get curious because you agreed with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really insightful thing, but that's true. Research really bears that out. You could say several things about it. And one of the techniques for undoing a yes but is you have to honestly sort of what we call join or agree with what's being said in pieces that you agree with. You know, one, the brain does wire that way. Two, you know, the more you do it, the further it gets into it. And brain research supports what you just said. You know, would you be interested in seeing how you could work with me to change that or change the response? And then you're in a conversation rather than a yes but pattern.
Right. And when I was reading the book, and I had to accept the fact that when I got to that portion of the book that was talking about yes buts, I had to look at it and say, yes, I can see me doing this. I mean, that. So that's probably the point that I started working on immediately in regards to myself, is that particular point, which is the yes but. And not only from the standpoint of me doing it, but at the same time recognizing, as you just did, that so many parents or people that I'm working with
right.
are doing the same thing.
And really what you said just now is so important, that in order for people to change, the first thing they have to do is recognize how they're not functioning well. Before, you know, sometimes people want to help everybody else because everybody else is a problem. The first thing to do is recognize, as you did, you said, I looked at this as something, you know, that I'm doing. And then you started quoting somebody else doing it and maybe didn't quite realize that. And that's the first step in change, is awareness. If you're, you know, for instance, let's say if you're very sarcastic with people and you don't know it, or you're kind of nasty and you may say insulting remarks and you don't know it, you can't really change that. Or if you complain all the time, you're whining. If you're not aware of it, you can't change it. And in our book, we talk about three steps. As Amy said, first to be aware. Second step is to have a plan or a strategy for how you actually change it. And the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth step is you got to practice, which is really the third step.
Yeah, and that's probably the most difficult part, I think, for most of us is to sit down and say, I've spent however many years practicing doing it the way that I've done it and preparing the grooves that I already have. I now have to put in, you know, however much time, you know, that, you know, rather than just think that I can do it once and it's going to somehow fix it. In fact, I'll ask you, there's been a lot of studies and stuff that suggest that about somewhere around 21 days, you know, is sometimes thrown around as a point in which if you can do something or not do something, whatever it is that you're trying to change. Is there any truth to that, or does it depend on how long you've been making that groove to begin with?
You know, I can't speak to that specific note. I have also heard that. I actually don't know if there's specific research to back it up or if it's just general common knowledge. What we've seen with participants in our workshop, clients who we've worked with, it really depends on how deep the groove is. And, you know, we could just take, say, complaining. And there are people who complain every once in a while, and once they learn a new strategy for complaining, they're pretty good at picking up when they're doing it and changing it. If it's something you've done your entire life and your whole family complains together and you're in a workplace where everybody complains together and you get all of this, and your kids complain to you, your spouse complains to you, and you have all of this reinforcement to your complaining behavior, it takes a little more work. I would say in our experience, 21 days is definitely a great start. If you can stick with anything for 21 days, I think you're in very good shape.
Let me add to that. The 21 days, I think, is an indicator of how much you have to practice. Like, for instance, when we have people practice, they're not going to practice every day. You know, they might practice a couple of times a week. Now, remember, if you did it a couple of times a week for a half an hour or an hour, and you did that 21 times, that would be 10 or 11 weeks. I would say that's pretty good. You know, that would be a good way to get a handle on it. And I certainly agree with what Amy said, that it depends on how long and how deep that groove is. But if you do something, most people don't do something new for 21 days in a row. If they did, I think it would be, you know, kind of fantastic. But again, it would only be a start for somebody, because these old habits die hard.
And I just like to say that that doesn't mean that, you know, nothing at all changes, and then on day 21, bing, you're wonderful and everything's fixed. Not only does it probably take a while before you can use these skills in really tough situations, but you also get to see benefits before then. So often what happens is, well, people might be able to say not yes, but when it's kind of a relaxed situation, they have time to think about it and it's not that charged. But when they're talking with, say, their mother-in-law or somebody who really pushes their buttons, then they get triggered and then they just fall back into that same old pattern. So this is another thing about the brain, that when we're really stressed, we tend to revert to whatever those old grooves are. Whenever we don't have the other sort of cognitive, emotional resources available to us, we're tired, we haven't eaten enough, and there's something else stressing us out, we will tend to go right back to that old pattern. So what happens is, over time, you get to be able to use these skills in more and more difficult situations. But you might be able to see some improvements fairly quickly.
I mean, one of the other things is the environment. Like, we like to train like a whole team of people or a whole family or, you know, some group. If everybody's aware of the same thing, you know, like we did a training in a school, and everybody did the training, from the janitor to the president. Everybody was in the training. So that everybody was aware of it. And so they could recognize it. They could help each other. And we have a special grid, a savvy grid, that shows every kind of behavior that's on the Conversation Transformation website, if anybody's interested. It shows any behavior that you could do in your whole life. And so what people do often is they put this grid up on the wall, and they point and say, hey, we're over here. Let's see if we can get out of that. We're like competing with each other. We're yes-butting each other. We're interrupting each other, whatever it is. And it's not personal anymore. It's just the way we're behaving at that moment. It's not our personality. It's what we're doing that we could possibly change, and especially if we're in an environment where everybody's trying to do it, or the whole family's trying to do it, the whole school is trying to do it, or your class, et cetera.
Now, when you're teaching something like that, I mean, are there specific red flags, you know, that are, you know, for instance, a red flag of a toxic conversation, and what are some of the ways that you can turn it around?
You know, like one red flag is, boy, that was stupid. You know, that would be one. Or I had a coaching client who said, you know, I just asked a question and he started attacking me. And I said, what was the question you asked? And he said, well, I asked, how could you do something like that? Not exactly a question. It was a question, but it's a question that we call a righteous question, which has no answer except, you know, if you put the word idiot at the end, you know, then it says, how could you do that, you idiot? You know, it's really an attack in a question form. So the first thing is to be aware that that's what you're doing. Now, I lost my thread here. Amy, can you explain?
Oh, yeah. So we're talking about red flags. And in the book, we couldn't focus on all of the red flags. That would be an encyclopedia, and maybe we'll do future books. But we focused on really the six most common patterns. So we focused on yes buts, which we've been talking about, or the token yes. Yes, I see your point, but my idea is better. Leading questions, don't you think we should do things my way? Complaints, which are the whining. Attacks, and mind reading, which is where I think I know what you're thinking or feeling. I know you don't really mean that, or I can tell you're really resentful about what I did. And then negative predictions, which is assuming that things are going to go badly. So those are six very, very, very common types of red flags that you might notice in a conversation. So our hope is, after somebody reads the books, does some of this awareness exercise, they can go back into a conversation, things start to go bad, and you start picking up your ears. You start to really notice what's happening, and you can say, oh, why do I feel so upset? Oh, this person is actually using verbal attacks on me. They just asked a righteous question, which is a type of attack, like Ben said. How could you be so stupid? Oh, this is what's happening. And then once you're aware of that, you can start to figure out, okay, well, here's how I can respond.
Yeah, one of the ways that we have people build their awareness is we have on our website, we have a little test, a little pre-test before people read the book. It takes about 10 minutes to do, and it kind of does an analysis of the areas that you're strong in and the areas that you want to work in around those particular behaviors that Amy mentioned. We also have a practice kind of game that people can do where a sentence comes up like, yeah, that's a great idea. And then you have to identify on this chart what it was. Like that was
sarcasm.
That was sarcasm. Okay. Or don't you think this is a great idea? You know, that's a leading question, et cetera. Or we have really subtle ones that are, you know, that are harder to get. And so people do a lot of practicing, and then they learn to recognize these behaviors in themselves and others more quickly.
Well, let me share. You mentioned about the website, and I checked it out, and I was very impressed. Now, for those of you that are not driving, you're sitting at your computer, you can go to this website, and you can see exactly what we're talking about. The website is www.savvycommunications.com. That's
No. Actually, conversationtransformation.com.
Oh, okay. Sorry, that's I had one that was printed out here. So go ahead and
conversationtransformation.com.
Okay. Got it.
The name of the book. That's all they need to put in.
Okay. ConversationTransformation.com. If you go to that website and you check it out, you can look at what it is that we're talking about as we're talking about it. Now, while you're doing that, we're going to take a break. We will be right back, and know that you're listening to Answers for the Family, and we are talking to Dr. Ben Benjamin and A.B. Yeager. We'll be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and the subject today is conversation transformation. We're talking with Dr. Ben Benjamin and Amy Yeager, and I mean, we're really touching on, I mean, kind of the bottom line is that there are certain things that some of us say that keeps us caught up in a negative conversation. And so they're really talking about things that we can do, ways that we can get away from those patterns and hopefully establish new patterns. So let me hit with one of the questions that I've been thinking about, and that is, what is just the biggest reason conversations fail? Is there one thing that sort of covers a wide variety of issues?
Probably lack of awareness that what you're doing. You know, like somebody might say, oh my, we're very fat today, aren't we? They might think that's a joke. They don't really know that's an attack. Or sometimes people kind of joke around with the sarcastic remarks and don't realize that at the edge of a sarcastic remark, there's a knife blade that goes into somebody, because often the sarcasm is at someone's expense. So when you're not aware and you're just merrily going along, that could be a huge issue, a huge problem for people.
Well, and I would say, to build on that, it's really not being aware of how you're saying what you're saying.
Right.
That's one of the big points of focus that we have. That you know, often when you're planning a conversation, you really think very hard about what you want to say, what message you want to get across, and that's where all your energy goes. You don't think so much about how you say it, you know, the package that it goes in, because you could have this really, really important piece of information. You want to tell somebody, you know, I'm really worried about you. I think you're putting yourself in danger. But you tell them that in this sarcastic way, in this, you know, angry way, in the snide way, and they don't get that message. What they hear is, you know, what are you trying to do, ruin your life? You actually have a really important message, which is you care about them, you're so worried about them, and you have information about the danger they might be in, But the way you say it makes it really impossible for them to hear that.
Now, are there particular words that we should just avoid, that from the standpoint of any conversation pattern, these words generally steer us in the wrong direction?
It's not so much the words as what Amy was just talking about. It's the voice tone. You can say almost anything and make it nasty. You know, how are you today? Or how are you today? How are you today? Or you can actually, you know, usually swear words are not, you know, that great to use in a conversation. But it's sometimes, you know, between people who are, know each other, sometimes a swear word is funny and it gets a point across in a way that's not nasty. So it's not so much the words as it's the voice tone, it's the context of the words. You know, for instance, laughing is usually very good. However, if somebody says, I'm really upset and need some help, and people start laughing at them, it's not very good, you know. So it just depends on the context of the situation, not so much a set of words that don't work. Amy, you got something to add?
Yeah, I would totally agree that often it's this edginess that leaks out in our voice tone. So when we teach about attacks, plenty of people think, oh, well, I don't use attacks because I don't say to, you know, people, oh, you stupid fat pig, you're so ugly. But they, you know, they might not use those words, but they might be, you know, at the end of a tired day saying, oh, what do you want? Oh, what is it? Okay, all right, fine. And so you get this sort of this edginess that really is an attack because you're venting out your frustration, your anger at somebody. So that's really important to be aware of and difficult to be aware of. Again, when you're under stress, these things just come out.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, and especially for those of us as parents, you know, that, you know, if we've had a tough day at work and we come home, you know, and our child asks us something, we need to understand that they're not aware of all of those other things that have happened in our day, and to sort of turn to them, you know, and say, now, what is it that you said you wanted? You know, they're not going to ask the next time, you know, unless we approach it with in a more kinder, loving manner. So, yeah, I would agree completely.
Yeah, it's really human nature, I think, to take things personally. And, you know, when you say, was there one problem in conversations, and I would say awareness is one, and another one is really our tendency to take things personally. And what we're hoping is this book will help people to do that a little bit less when they're more educated. But, you know, with kids especially, you know, when you snap at them, it may be because you had a horrible day at work, there was bad traffic, you're worried about the economy, whatever it is, if you snap at them, it's going to feel personal.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And they're going to think they did something wrong, they're bad, you know, and they're going to withdraw, you know. So you got to be very, very careful about your communication, not to bring one context into another, but to, you know, get yourself human before you get home if you're feeling nasty.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you something, and I'm not trying to turn this into a political conversation, but I think anybody, unless they were living under a rock, knows that we just went through a political candidacy debate, and so most people out there heard a lot of things. They heard a lot from both sides. Now, what can people like, you know, Mitt Romney or Barack Obama or any other candidates learn from conversation transformation? Or what are some of the things that you observed, you know, that was going on out there that you looked at and thought, wow, they could have really, you know, learned a little bit from this technique or that technique? Or on the other hand, what are some techniques that they did that were great and you noticed it and went, wow, that was really a great way to deal with that?
Well, one of the things is the difference between an opinion and real data, you know, facts. And that's something that candidates could really do well, to have fact checkers of their own before they open their mouth, you know, to really have their facts and also say where their facts came from. Because if you just give an opinion and do it snidely or whatever way you do it, that's not going to be as powerful as real, backed up, you know, facts. And so I'd say that's one area that most politicians don't do that well at. And in these days, we have fact checkers out there. So 10 minutes after the thing, you know who is not telling the truth, unless it was kind of gray. But oftentimes it's pretty black and white, and they just completely distorted something. And certainly all sides do that. So I think that would make the debate a lot richer, a lot better.
And it would certainly benefit the voters. It's, you know, it's really hard to say with elections that, you know, part of what we're trying to do in conversation transformation is help people to get a message across effectively, help to create mutual understanding, to prevent needless arguments. When you have an election, sometimes the goals are different. You really want to attack the other party. excuse me. And so interest groups will, you know, sometimes not give real data, just give all of these sort of unfounded opinions and really attack the other candidate. And that may help to, you know, really roil up opinions and roil up emotions in voters. But it often doesn't serve us. There's a interesting article online about charisma and the dangers of charisma, that we tend to be really drawn in by a charismatic leader who, you know, has a lot of energy and can stir up lots of emotion. And that can blind us to the facts. That can blind us to their record. So it would be great for us as voters if we actually had, you know, more concrete information, not just how compelling does this person seem and how excited are we about them and how angry are we at the other person, but, well, what have they actually done in their career, and what have they pledged to do, and what's the data behind that?
And I mean, we could learn a lot from other countries in terms of elections. In other countries, they have a cap of, like, you know, $40 million, and mm-hmm. it's over in 3 months. We could benefit greatly by learning from other countries in that. So people have to get down to the facts or get down to information more quickly, and wouldn't be, you know, spending tons of money just trying to, you know, get their point across in an emotional, distorted message.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Now, are there times in which it's best just to shut up?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, if you're not invested in a relationship, you know, somebody, like in the street, attacks you, and you're not invested in a relationship, you just don't take it personally, you just leave, you know, or if you're in a situation where you're thinking somebody is upset with something, but you're not in the relationship, it doesn't matter to you, it's not going to affect your life, you don't care about it. So not usually worth it, you know, investing in it. However, if something matters to you, then it's worth investing the time and the energy to do something about it.
Yeah, once you're in a place to be able to do it, I would say we could all benefit from sometimes keeping our mouth shut when what's going through our head is something that we don't want to have come out of our mouth.
Yeah.
And this, again, gets to the sort of edginess in your voice. So even if you can make your words be civil, but you're really still angry and what's going through your head is attacking the other person, it's going to come out somehow. You could say, like Ben said with the righteous questions, you're trying to just ask somebody a question, you know, what do you mean? And it comes out, what do you mean by that?
Yeah.
And so then, yeah, sometimes better to say nothing at all.
Absolutely. And if people often give you invitations, like couples usually invite people into a fight,
uh-huh.
and they say something that's really provocative, and it's usually good to just nod your head and say nothing, because uh-huh. it was an invitation to a fight, and maybe catch it later and say, well, can we talk about, you know, blah, 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 rather than, well, what do you think about that? Or how
right.
come you did that? You know, you don't want to respond to the invitation like that. You want to respond to an invitation that lets you have a real conversation, not a mindless kind of fighting.
Yeah, and if you are angry, people often think of anger as being bad, and there are these negative emotions, and anger is actually not bad in and of itself. It's the way it leaks out. But if you directly say, I'm feeling really angry right now, sometimes that's direct, honest, it's not complicated, it's not blaming the other person, and you can just say that, you know, I'm feeling too angry to have this conversation right now.
Instead of saying, you're acting like a jerk.
Right, I'm angry because
right.
because of you. Let me
yeah.
tell you why.
Yeah, those things are very different. Attacks and anger are quite different, and people mush them together.
Right, and you even have a chapter in the book of, you know, the blame games, and it just mm-hmm. seems like, you know, that is something that just happens so much now, is that, you know, there's very few people want to go into something accepting responsibility. They want to go in and find a way to blame.
Right. I mean, this should really start in first grade. People should be learning communication every year, you know, 101, 102, 103, or, you know, right through all of school. You know, we don't have any classes in communication until we get to college, and then, of course, then it's a class on computers.
Well, I think, yeah, really getting education would help people, you know, with things like attacks, to find a different way of thinking. So if people are used to trying to find who's to blame, well, it makes sense you'd want to blame the other person, because otherwise, whose fault is it? Well, it's yours. You know, if you're in a marriage and, you know, the marriage is failing and you keep having arguments and you think, well, somebody's to blame, either you blame the other person or you think, God, I'm just awful and I always fail in my relationships. And both of those have the same effect. So the challenge is, how do you get through that to actually solving problems and really working through the deep, often painful emotions?
Right. And as you were saying that, it reminded me of a conversation that I've had with multiple parents, but one in particular, and they came to me and they were blaming, and the blame was that their child had been to three different programs, and my company had located them and took them to each program. Each time they would run away or come back home and backslide, as the client put it, they would go back into old habits. And so, and in his frustration, and he says, I don't know what to do. He goes, why are these programs failing my daughter? I don't get it. And I said, well, I don't know. I said, have you sat down and really looked at what the common denominators are? And he got real quiet for a minute, and he went, oh, it's me. Mm. You know, so, you know, getting that realization. Now, obviously, most people don't get the realization kind of that quickly. But mm-hmm. But as you say, you know, rather than try and defend or attack back, because here he was kind of attacking an industry that I support very much, and I know that they do great things with kids and stuff. And and that was one of those situations to where I think I, you know, I kept my tongue and just presented a question back and let him find the answer themselves.
That's great.
Without telling him. I think if I would have told him, well, you know, do you notice that she comes back to your home every time? I think we would have just had an argument. So, yeah. Now, one of the things I want to make sure that we touch on before we run out of time, and the time is just flying by, is I'd love to know more, and I think the listeners would too, more about Savvy. So if you can share us.
Pronounce Savvy, actually.
Savvy. Okay.
Savvy.
Savvy.
So Savvy is a system that was created more than 40 years ago by two women, Anita Simon and Yvonne Agazarian. And it was actually in an educational context. They were looking at classrooms and looking at classrooms where things were going really great and the students were thriving and learning, and other classrooms where they weren't doing so well. And they wanted to find an objective way of saying, okay, well, what's happening that makes the difference for these kids? And what are the teachers specifically doing? What are the students doing? What are the behaviors that are happening so that we can understand them and actually reproduce it someplace else? And so they developed this really systematic framework that can look at any conversation. It could be a business meeting, it could be a family meeting, it could be even a conversation with yourself. And you can analyze, you know, every 3 seconds you can code it and say, okay, here's what's happening. Oh, there's lots of opinions coming up. Oh, there's some yes butting. Oh, now there's attacking. And you can really pinpoint the moment something starts to go wrong, and look at, okay, what needs to come into the conversation to make things go better. So this system has been used for really over 40 years in couples and families and in organizations to help conversations work better. And our book, Conversation Transformation, is the first book that's exclusively about Savvy to really bring this into the world. Do you have anything to add?
Yes, it's kind of like owning a private X-ray machine. It's like having a superpower. And you can look at a conversation, and you can tell what's going on here. Not only what's making it go wrong, but also what's making it go right. So that you know what you're doing, when things go badly, and you know what you're doing when things go well. And it's a really a wonderful system to have at your disposal to help you have a better life.
And again, and this is our entire chapter 9, our last chapter is devoted to it, and it's focused on behaviors rather than personality, intention, motivation, which tends to get people into trouble. You think, the problem with my conversation is his bad attitude or, this aggression or something that you'd have to go into years of therapy to change. No, and this just looks at behavior, which you can all, we can all change by, as we talked about, getting some practice and changing your habits will change your brain. And it's something we all have power to transform.
Now, if anybody's out there and they and again, if you want to get the book, again, is it at every bookstore, or is it best for them to go to the website? What is the best way for them to get the book?
You can go on Amazon. It's at most bookstores, big bookstores, and get it on Amazon. It'll come right to you, no problem.
Okay, so that's Conversation Transformation. And there is some information in the last chapter about savvy. And but if they want to just, if somebody's out there with an organization, a school or something, do they go to your website? Would that be the best thing to do?
They go to our website, and then they can just email us right from that.
Okay.
And no problem.
That sounds great. And here, before we run out of time, there's an email that has just come over that I want to read to you. And this one says, "What a great topic. As an English and history teacher, I have been criticized by other teachers for diverting off the traditional path and curriculum. My students are assigned research lessons each month, which require they examine the language and presentation skills of present day and historical figures in politics and business. And it doesn't end there. They are also asked to create presentations that would influence others to follow their point of view. This new understanding and use of words has resulted in great improvement and with their interactions with each other in the classroom. I plan on purchasing your book and sharing it with the class next week, as it is exactly what I need to keep the momentum going. Many thanks." This is a GD from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
That's great.
Well, and I think it goes right into what you were saying earlier about, if we could start this in school, if we could start
Absolutely.
Getting the younger children to start transforming their conversation, I think we wouldn't have situations like this, to where you have a teacher who's being criticized by the other teachers for really helping the kids.
Part of what he's saying is just having the information is not good enough. It's how what you do with the information that's important, how you communicate the information, and he wants them to study that, and that sounds terrific.
As I was reading it, I was thinking maybe he should get the book for the teachers that are criticizing him also.
Yeah, people have said that. Yeah, I don't just want it for myself. I want to give it to. I want to force my boss to read this.
Well, we hope to create a little revolution in the world and have people really start thinking about communication not as a soft skill, as it's often referred to, but as a hardwiring skill in your brain, which it really is. And in order to change it, you got to do a piece of work. And over time, you've got to do that work. And it's got to be something that's important to you. And not only does it help your work life, your bottom line, your interactions at work, but it helps people tell us when we train them. It helps them with their kids. It helps them with their spouse. It helps them with their interactions in their life, in their church, et cetera.
And it does take time. And people will say, I don't know if I have time for this. We all have really busy lives. Well, if you think about how much time is wasted in having the same argument over and over and over again, the same repeated conversations. There's a great line, who is Gay Hendricks, who said, most couples don't have hundreds of arguments. They have the same argument hundreds of times. And I think we can all relate to that. So we find that this actually really saves companies, schools, groups, families, lots of time.
Just retraining one employee, a manager, costs $100,000. And you have turnovers sometimes of, dozens of people in a large company. It's costing them millions of dollars because they're not keeping people, because they're either being scapegoated and fired, or they're not doing a good job because they don't know how to function on the team in a cooperative manner. So it really saves you lots and lots of misery, and it saves you lots of money if you know how to communicate well.
Well, I want to thank you. You've communicated this message really well, and you've done so well that we are out of time. Another email question came over. I think that the answer is obvious, so you probably only need a one-word answer, but it's just, you know, my younger sister was recently sent to a psychologist because of her inability to communicate with others. She is extremely shy and withdrawn. I believe much of her problem is a lack of confidence in verbally expressing herself. Could your book be of benefit to her? I mean, I think
you're right. That is easy. Yes.
Yeah. So I think that one is a yes, as I think it can for lots of other people. Thank you so much. And I know that I will be in touch with you, because I think it's important not only for me, but for my team of people within my company to also do everything they can to communicate at the highest level. So,
great.
Ben,
let's have a conversation.
Thank you so much. I look forward to it.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.